8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
This is KHOI, Story City, Ames, and surrounding areas.
Welcome to Local Talk Tuesday, where we explore the people, places, stories, and events of our Central Iowa community. Thank you for tuning in. I am Mike Metz, your host for this hour. Engineering this morning's program is KHOI's Paul Hertz, and KHOI's Sam Wormley is also joining us this morning. It's 70 degrees currently, and today we will see plenty of sunshine with a daytime high of 98 degrees. Winds will be south-southwest at 5 to 10 miles per hour. This evening, we can expect scattered thundershowers. Some may be severe overnight, and our low will get down to 72 degrees. And we will have easterly winds from 5 to 10 miles an hour. Dr. Passion is joining us from Story County Board of Health. Good morning, Dr. Passion.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us. And
you're very welcome.
The usual question, where are we with the COVID virus as far as Story County is concerned?
You know, that's a very good question. It's really kind of hard to tell because a lot of people are doing home tests. And so to know the true rate is very, very difficult. The last thing I looked at said we're having about 13, 12 cases a day. Hospitalizations are down, but it's still out there.
Are all those tests capable of picking up the variants that are starting to show up?
Yes, as far as I know, I've not heard anything yet that the home antigen tests are not picking these up.
Okay. Now, I've had some folks that have tested and will test. The test will show that they're positive, but they have no outward symptoms. Maybe they've been exposed to somebody. What would that indicate? And should they do a second test to verify that that, in fact, was a true answer?
It's a good question. The recommendations are that a positive antigen test is a positive test. You might not have symptoms because you have a very low viral load or you've been vaccinated. So you still have to isolate, and the recommendations are that if you're feeling good and you positive, you can come out of isolation after 5 days, but use a mask for another 5 days.
Okay. So if you test positive but are showing no outward symptoms, you can still shed or pass the virus on to other individuals.
At least as far as we know.
Yeah, okay. Last month when Dr. Lee was with us, we just briefly touched on vaccines for the younger folks. Do you have more information on vaccines in children?
Well, we have two now for children between 6 months and 4 to 5 years of age. There are differences. The Moderna vaccine is a two-shot series, works about 40 to 50% of the time. The Pfizer vaccine is a three-shot series. They're given about 3 to 8 weeks apart. The Pfizer vaccine has an efficacy of 81%. However, though, before you make it seem like I'm recommending the Pfizer vaccine, there will probably be a third Moderna vaccine that will be coming out very soon, and the efficacy will probably increase for Moderna.
So it would
be a very safe vaccine?
Yes.
And actually effective.
And so is this the age group we're talking about, children, say, 5 and older? Or
no, this is 6 months to 5 years of age.
Okay, so infants right up to toddler and beyond.
Right, and this is actually the first time in pediatrics where we've had two vaccines that have been approved at the same time for the same group.
Okay, this would be a good thing to incorporate into the normal vaccination regime that the young folks would be getting as they get older, and in some cases start entering kindergarten, the school age years.
Yeah, we hope that that's exactly what will happen. Like all new vaccines that are not required, there are rapid adopters, people who will get their children vaccinated right away, and others that just will not. They'll wait a little bit. We're just going to have to see how this goes.
Okay. What about individuals, say, who have gotten both boosters? Is there a booster on the horizon for them? Are we looking at something for fall? Or what's the status for older age groups?
Yeah, that's a very good question. We're hearing more and more about a vaccine for the Omicron variant of COVID, which was the one that was so highly contagious, especially in pediatrics. We expect that to be available in the fall. Some people have wondered about the idea of waiting until the fall to get your Omicron-specific COVID vaccine. Might not be a terrible idea, but we still recommend all of us that you get at least your primary series. And to be quite honest, if you're going to travel any place this summer, I would recommend getting the booster before you travel.
Okay.
And that means travel any place, whether you're traveling to Puerto Rico or whether you're traveling to Wisconsin.
Sure.
If you're leaving your home and you're going to be with a lot of different people, you should try to get that booster at the very least at this time and not wait for the Omicron specific one. There's a pretty good chance that you'll be able to get that anyways, even if you've had all your boosters.
Okay, so is there a recommendation from your second booster to this third booster as far as time frame?
Right now, the vaccine, the third and fourth booster should be about 5 months apart. And the recommendations are to take it when you can take it.
Yeah, okay.
I'm just trying to address what some people are thinking about doing. There'll be no problems if you get an extra vaccine.
If anything, and they'll probably help you out because you're getting you're getting a good jolt to your system.
Right.
And in building up your immunity so you're a little more protected.
Yeah, and that brings up another point. It seems that the data continues to be stronger and stronger that the best protection against COVID-19 and being real sick with it is to get the disease and the vaccine. So it seems like that's the best immunity out there. So if you get the disease, should not stop you from getting vaccinated.
Okay, that was going to be a question. The problem is that getting the disease has an effect on different people in different ways, of course. So
that's
kind of like shaking the dice.
What I don't quite understand that.
Well, what I mean is with some of the side effects, if you get without having been vaccinated, if you're exposed to the organism without any vaccination, your risks are very high. Is that correct?
Absolutely.
Yes.
Yep. Yep,
and
there's no question at all about that.
Okay, and then if you are vaccinated and maybe have some of the series of boosters, you get the disease, you're protected, so the symptoms or the side effects are very much less, and you're going to probably not feel well, but you're not going to have all of the symptoms that are life-threatening.
That is exactly right, and that is why even if you get the disease, you should still get vaccinated.
Okay.
Because it'll keep you from getting it again.
Very good.
And also, keep in mind that you're vaccinating not to necessarily protect yourself, but also to protect other people.
Which is another reason when you're in groups of folks, a face mask is just a given. Because unless you're outdoors, and of course, it depends which way the wind's blowing. If you're indoors, you don't know what the air handling system is all about. It's better to be on the safe side, in my book.
Yeah, absolutely. Let me give you a little personal example. I was recently on a volunteer trip to Zimbabwe, and one of the volunteers was sick when they came in. And they thought that they were just sick because they were on an 18-hour plane flight. Well, after about 2 to 3 days of being sick, they went ahead and got tested and they were COVID positive. In that meantime, because the rules state that if you're with your group, you can let your guard down, don't have to wear a mask. You should just wear a mask out in public. So several people in our volunteer group got COVID, me being one of them.
Even though probably essentially everybody was vaccinated.
Everyone was vaccinated. Oh. I'm 62, but I wasn't sick with it. You know, I had a sore throat, and that was about it. But it just tells you that it's out there. And it just reiterated in my own mind that travel is a risk factor for getting this disease.
Right. Is there a situation where if you don't test yourself, could you have it and not realize it?
Absolutely.
Okay. So
that's true with almost any disease.
Sure.
That you can have it. The thought is that if you're not symptomatic with it, you might not spread it as much, but we're not sure of that.
Okay. Anything else you would like to address with COVID, or is there something else you'd like to discuss while we still have a couple of minutes?
Well, might as well talk about the thing that everyone seems to be worried about is monkeypox.
Yeah, what's our status here?
Yeah. Well, here it's okay.
Well, I was wondering. I reached for bananas this morning, and I just.
You know, actually, monkeypox, they don't really know the reservoir for this disease. It's really not from a monkey. Apparently, it got its name when it showed up in some research animals that they were doing smallpox research on.
Okay.
Monkeypox is related to the smallpox virus, not as serious. Mm-hmm. It's in Africa, Central and West Africa, endemically, but now it's starting to be seen in some countries in Europe and now the United States. Right now, the group that tends to be the most affected by it are men who have sex with men. We don't know where it's going to spread at this point. It tends to be it's extremely less serious than smallpox, of course. Right now, knock on wood, no one has died from monkeypox outside of the endemic areas with this current outbreak. So we're going to have to keep our eyes and ears open to that. There is a vaccine available. It's the smallpox vaccine. And they're talking about whether or not to start giving it to people when they've been exposed to monkeypox.
Oh, okay. So it's part of that whole group of pox viruses, it sounds like, in that same family?
Yes, that's exactly right.
Okay.
And might I just add that the viral inclusion bodies seen in smallpox are known as passion bodies.
So
seriously, my same last name.
Yeah. So somewhere in the past, you probably had an ancestor who was doing research on this, for all you know.
Absolutely. Yeah, there you go. That's right. Enrique Passion. No relation, I'm sure.
Okay. I know that one thing that we might want to just ask you, because of the weather situation that we're having, we've got folks that are outside working in this heat and humidity. Are there some things that you would recommend for folks as far as staying hydrated? What kind of precautions should we be taking with weather like this?
Very good question. Remember to wear a wide-brim hat as much as possible. For men, a baseball cap works really nicely. I tend to, when I'm working outside in weather like this, I tend to tie a handkerchief around my neck, mm-hmm. that's soaked in cool water. That seems to help me a lot. And drink water. Nobody drinks enough water in this hot, humid weather. Nobody does. Mm-hmm. I try to hydrate myself aggressively when I'm working outside, and I still do not drink enough water.
Mm-hmm. And if you can, take your breaks in the shade and hope for a little breeze.
And hope for a little breeze.
Yeah. Now, if somebody wasn't feeling too well, could we talk about just briefly the difference between heat stroke and heat exhaustion?
Heat stroke is when your internal temperature goes up. And heat exhaustion is actually when you're just really tired and fatigued, and all you really need to do is get out of the heat and drink a lot of fluids.
Okay. So heat stroke, your body is actually starting to shut down.
Right.
Okay. And that's where you definitely need medical attention.
Absolutely.
Okay. Okay, Dr. Passion, is there anything else you want to add? We've got about 30 seconds.
No, I can't really think of anything. What I do want to tell people is that with the COVID vaccine, what we call baby COVID vaccine, right now, not a lot of pharmacies are giving it. So the place you can get it is at the clinic here in town, public health. More clinics may start giving it.
Okay.
But right now, those are the two biggest areas that you can get it. We do recommend it quite highly because while deaths from COVID are still very rare in children, the thing that we do not know about kids is what they play in passing this along to other people.
Okay.
Certainly with other viral illnesses, they have been the vectors. We know that with influenza.
Mm-hmm.
We've known that with chickenpox. We've known that with measles. But we don't really know that yet with COVID, but I can't help to believe, I cannot believe that they're not part of it spreading. So get your children vaccinated, not only for them, but for everybody else.
Thank you, Dr. John Passion, chair of the Story County Board of Health. We'll visit with you again next month. Thanks for joining us.
Okay, very good. Thank you very much.
I'm here with Steve Lekwa, past director of Story County Conservation, and we're going to talk about his column, Naturally Speaking.
Yeah. Months ago, I had agreed to do a talk, and they wanted me to talk about writing the column, Naturally Speaking. And I said, sure. Well, at the time, I had no idea that by now I wouldn't be writing it anymore. I had run some notes just this morning, and Sue is going to make some slides so it isn't just me talking. Talk about 44 years of some of the background about why Bob Pinicky urged me to start writing it, what was going on at the time, and what we thought we could gain by it. And some of the technology things that have come during that time from sitting out in the little shop office with a manual portable, typing double-spaced and penciling in the edits, and the editors at each paper would pencil in more and hand-delivering hard copy to the papers that they'd have to put into print form, and then getting an IBM Selectric with a built-in correct tape. That was really uptown. Seal Burnett dragging me, kicking and screaming, into the computer age with our first DOS-based system that took 2 5-inch floppy disks just to get it booted up to run. And then what you saw on the screen wasn't what was going to be on the page. I mean, and the text was there, but it wasn't, I think the term that my sister-in-law used was WYSIWYG. What you see is what you get. That was a few more years in the future when I got my first Mac SE. But it was years later, even after that, before we started sending digital copy to the papers.
Over the years, many folks enjoyed sharing your personal day. An example would be using the constellation Orion as a reminder in the early fall.
That was one I liked. And there was sometimes it was just that. It was sharing an experience, you know. Come hunting with me some morning. And that morning going out, and I was by myself, but
yeah.
I met my old friend at the parking lot.
Mm-hmm.
But he had a brighter headlight than I did.
Yeah.
He finally turned mine off. And it was Orion with about a half moon right ahead.
So it was like his headlamp.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And he was behind me. I figured as long as he was behind me, I knew I was going north.
Okay.
Because it was still dark.
Oh, that's good. Do you still write?
On a weekly basis.
A journal or?
Writing for the Iowa Woodland Owners newsletter that they call Timber Talk. Similar type column there, but usually forest related, of course. I've got another one of those coming due next month. Well, since I learned that they weren't going to publish it. But in the last month, I haven't.
I think you need to periodically share some of your thoughts with us. Like today, let's talk about your tree planting.
Okay.
Why were you planting trees today?
One of the reasons is that we started a program over there called the Future Forest Program because Camp Mitigua is celebrating its 100th year this year.
Okay.
You won't find many woodlands in Iowa that haven't been grazed for 100 years. That's one of them. A lot of their trees to mature levels, some of them in decline. When we started that program back in 2014, emerald ash borer hadn't hit yet. They don't have a lot of ash trees over there, but some, and they're dying.
And then, of course, we had the derecho.
Then the derecho, yeah, which just devastated those areas there. They were really hard hit. Hardly a tree in camp, other than down in the bottom of the valleys, wasn't at least damaged.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them completely blown down. Some of the big old oaks stripped of all but their main big limbs. Just piles. And the campsites have been cleared, but some of the areas between sites still have trees just shoved aside in them.
Mm-hmm.
Their activity areas, and the main focal areas, are usable now, but the rifle range, for instance, had a wonderful white pine grove all around it, and shade and everything, and virtually every tree is snapped off halfway up. 50-year-old trees.
Mm. Was this site, if I remember being there a couple times, probably was an oak, hickory oak savanna type of a...
Oak hickory, upland, red oak, hard maple, and the north-facing slopes, a little bit of basswood, white ash. Boy, there were some white ash specimens down the valley walls that were incredible trees. You know, there's black cherry in the uplands. There are, in addition to white oak and bur oak, there was also a chinkapin oak along some of the ridges.
Those are unusual this far north, aren't they? Or are we in the border?
We're border, but they grow well there. It's been a seed source. The nursery we're using, Iowa Native Trees and Shrubs, only about 3 miles south of camp. They can tell you the source from seed for every tree they're growing.
By using them, you're planting a diversity of trees.
We're adding a lot more diversity. Other things that he's been able to locate and harvest, things like American hornbeam, mussel wood. You don't see in a lot of our smaller stream woods, but along the Des Moines River Valley, the bigger woods, and you begin to see some things like that. We've added some things that wouldn't normally have been there, like buckeye.
Yeah.
You find it native in the Raccoon Valley down by Des Moines. The big old swamp white oaks, the Chautauqua, those have been used as a seed source. And we, in fact, the two I planted today were swamp whites descended from those trees.
For an understory there, I assume hop hornbeam.
Hop horn,
and
is it more dominant? American hornbeam, less common. Choke cherry.
Hackberry.
American. There's some hackberry down in the valleys.
Service berry?
I haven't seen much of that.
Okay.
That's one that I'd like to start adding more shrubbery. They've been really focusing.
I would assume on the edges there might be some wild plum.
And again, I haven't been able to get into shrubs very much.
Yeah,
I wanted to use some prairie crab apple, and I got a few in out on the edge of their planted prairie. Trying to keep things that are appropriate for the site.
Mm-hmm.
But a few things now, we're stretching it a bit just to add diversity. We added big tooth aspen as a quick grower where they lost some trees near the parking area. We've added tulip poplar, which again is north of its usual native, doing real well. There's an old one in the ranger residence's yard that survived the derecho, but in kind of damaged state.
Sycamore and catalpa?
Yeah, we've planted some sycamore. Catalpa we haven't yet, but we probably will.
Because I would think there'd be some of that in that
valley at all? Seen.
Okay.
Sycamore, again, down by the river, but in the uplands.
Okay. How about the ephemerals? With the loss of the tree canopy, did you notice more ephemerals this spring?
I didn't get in there to really evaluate that a lot during that April-May period. In the camp proper, and in an area that we ran a trail 25 years ago down through the valley, we call that the Lakefront Trail, and that area was already just heavy with things like snow trillium and some hepatica, wood bentony, maidenhair fern,
dogtooth violet,
yeah, you know,
the
normal things.
Mm-hmm.
When I've been over there, I haven't had time to really range out into the undeveloped, unused parts of camp very much.
Yeah, okay.
I wondered about that, and even whether the increase in light would allow some native oak regeneration that was too shady before. And there might be if it weren't for the deer herd.
Yeah.
We don't deer plant anything without covering it immediately with deer enclosures around each tree.
Otherwise, you're just setting up a salad bar for them.
And it doesn't take them 2 days to find them.
Right.
I was talking to the new manager at the nursery today about that. I said, what is it? I mean, there's a forest full of greenery out there for them to eat. What is it about that newly planted tree that's so attractive? Well, we've been planting mostly oak. He said, well, one thing is, of course, the nursery trees are irrigated, fertilized. They're putting out a lot of new succulent growth. Most of the forest trees have put out most of their new growth for the year now, and things are hardening off. And once that happens, tannins begin to accumulate in the oak leaves,
mm-hmm.
and they're less attractive. But this new growth hasn't got the buildup of tannins yet. It's still sweet and juicy.
Right.
My first experience with that was the first year we were going to do, back in 14, I had brought over, we had two pickup loads of trees we brought in from the nursery, and this was a spring planting. The nursery stock hadn't really budded out a lot yet. It was little new greenery just coming out. So we had them all just stacked up in the parking lot, ready to go for the next day. Hmm. We had hardly gotten out of sight, and four deer were moving right toward them. So we thought, did somebody ring the dinner bell?
Yeah.
So we moved all of them into a fenced area
uh-huh.
by their shop. And ever since then, we don't dare leave unprotected trees out.
I think it's in all the Leopold's Sand County Almanac, he has made the comment about an oak tree is probably about 10 years older than it appears, because between the deer and the rabbits continually hitting
them. Knocking them back. Walnuts, too.
Yeah.
And walnuts, I would think, would be not very tasty, but deer sure like to nip off the terminals until that year that the root is big enough that it can send a sucker shoot up above what the deer reach.
That and where their population is maybe on the down cycle.
Something that they get beyond that. They still may get barked up, but and they've done that too. I mean, trees that they didn't eat, the young bucks have thrashed to death. But that's really about, with only a couple of exceptions and over 200 trees, our only losses have been to a couple to young bucks, three oaks to a poorly managed prairie burn. Yeah, we've had way in excess of 90% survival. Part of it's the really super quality stock. They were one of the first to start using the, I think they call it air pruning bags. It's almost like a mesh bag mm-hmm. that they're grown in. And when the roots hit that, they don't turn and circle like they do in a container. They just kind of stop and then bush out into the root ball. So super dense root balls. Very few, if any, circling roots. I still look for them, but it's just a vast network of little stub roots right to the edge of the sack. Start sending new roots out.
What kind of birds were you seeing today or hearing? Matigua.
Matigua.
Do you hear any rose-breasted grosbeaks or anything?
No,
Dick Sissels out in the prairie edge?
When I was out there marking where some trees would go, I heard what I think may have been a scarlet tanager, the sore throat robin call. I couldn't find him. I was hearing the usual robins and cardinal chorus in the morning. And that hatch on his way through. The last year that I was over there camped as a scoutmaster back in about 99 or so, 2000. During the week at camp, I had seven different singing male scarlet tanagers located.
Wow.
They spend all their time way up on the top of the canopy.
And that's the problem. The canopy is so thick right now, even a red bird you can't see.
Yeah. And I could hear them, and I thought, robin, vireo, nah, it's too scratchy.
Yeah.
But I couldn't find them. This spring, we learned that the Trees Forever program had secured a $12,000 grant to help the scout camp replace some of the trees they've lost. we worked out with the Iowa Native Trees and Shrubs, the nursery. So we wanted to keep that going to keep utilizing that grant funding. But now we're probably going to put in a bigger effort in September when the weather will be a little more conducive to tree planting, we hope. Maybe do a 20 or 30 tree day when we have a work day.
So in September, you'd want to hit it early September so there's some root development. Yeah. Before.
I think the day that's been selected as a Saturday work day, typically the way things are going anymore, that'll give them time to heal in and become established.
But water is still, in fact, water may be more critical at that time to
definitely
get them established.
You want them to go into the winter well hydrated, and that, I'm afraid a lot of newly planted trees don't get that first growing season, more intensive care, right up to the time of freeze-up. If you don't get rain or something to keep that soil moist, especially evergreens, newly planted pines, spruces, junipers, got to get out there and get that water on them late fall so that they don't dry out too much in the winter.
You know, I've seen some folks that will use like a burlap windbreak or something for evergreens because, like you say, they tend to dry out because of the needle.
You hit a warm stretch in the winter and their roots are locked in frost, their needles are responding to the sun and the wind, and they do respirate and dry out. That'll show as winter burn the next year. If you can get them really well hydrated going into the freeze-up, they're usually better at surviving that.
Thanks, Steve. We'll visit again.
We will, Mike.
Just joining us, it's about 30 minutes after the hour, give or take, and we now have Susan Gwiazda from the city of Ames. Good morning, Susan.
Good morning. Good to be here.
Yeah.
I hope everybody had a great holiday weekend.
Well, I think we started out with a nice shower and some natural fireworks, but throughout the day things improved other than being a little hot and lots of lemonade and water.
Yeah, it was a warm one. And we did have an outage on Monday. During the holiday, we had an actual rather large outage for Ames, about 15,000 customers, and we serve about 25,000. So 15,000 customers went out on Monday afternoon. There was a breaker issue at one of our substations, and it affected Central and West Ames.
Mm-hmm.
The good news is that we were able to get most of those people back up within an hour, and within 2 hours, we think we got everybody back. It's a good reminder to have this number handy in your cell phone, the power outage number.
Yes.
515-239-5420-5420. Memorize it. It's just a good idea if you're ever experiencing a power outage to report your address. And doesn't matter if your neighbors have reported it, doesn't matter if different apartments in your building have reported it. It's an automated system. Call in your address. You don't have to have your account number. If you're calling from a different telephone, you will go through some additional prompts that ask you, what address are you calling about? If you have your number in the system, it'll recognize it right away and say, is this the address that you want to report out? And of course, we've talked about it before on KHOI. If you've associated your cell phone number, you can text in your outage.
Yeah, I think it was just a great fortuitous event that we talked about it the week prior to this. So I think there were probably some folks that wrote that number down and were able to call in.
I hope so, but I feel like it's always a good message to repeat because you just never know who you missed.
Exactly.
And you never know who forgot to write it down.
Yeah. Okay. Are there any upcoming meetings before we get to your guest?
Our first meeting of Tuesday will happen this coming Tuesday. Of course, today is the first Tuesday of the month, so our second Tuesday is always the first council meeting. That's a bit of a tongue twister. I believe that is July 12th is our first meeting. Again, find all the information about our city council meetings on our website, cityofames.org/ccmeetings. So it's a good way to bookmark and see what's on the agenda.
Okay, very good. And you have Rich Iverson joining us today. He's the fleet support manager. Good morning, Rich.
Good morning.
Well, glad you could join us. What are we talking about? What do we mean by fleet for the city of Ames?
So the city of Ames has about 250 on-road vehicles, which includes police cars, fire trucks, snowplow trucks, all of the pickup trucks and utility trucks, all of the electric utility trucks that we have for the city of Ames. So we have quite a diverse fleet of vehicles that serve the community. And we have in the fleet department, we have pretty much everything except for the SciRide buses. That's a separate department.
Okay. And so with the fleet, you mentioned electric vehicles. So we're talking about a variety of fuels here. And I know one thing that you were wanting to talk about today and are somewhat have some great information on, and that's the biofuels portion of the fleet.
Yeah, that's correct. So just as a quick breakdown, about 50% of the vehicles in the fleet, that includes the a lot of the off-road vehicles as well, is on some sort of alternative fuel. The diesel vehicles have been on a B20 program since about 1997. About 3 years ago, we had a unique partnership to do a pilot project with the local company, REG. When I say local, they're actually a global company, but headquartered here in Ames, and another company out of Pennsylvania, Optimus Technologies, which allowed us to equip our snowplow trucks with technology that can use 100% biodiesel year-round, even in the winter. And why that's special is because we have a biodiesel will gel or get a cloud point at about 30 degrees Fahrenheit. And when that happens, then the truck doesn't want to run. So this technology warms the fuel, and so we can use it at any temperatures well below zero. We've had it in as low as 25 below. Without incident of any kind. So it's performed very well for us.
Okay.
Most importantly, the biodiesel program over the past a little over two and a half years now has saved us about 250 metric tons of carbon. That's what we've been able to offset. Our carbon offset is about 250 metric tons.
So is this a biodiesel, or is this a biodegradable material that is used to generate that, to produce that biodiesel?
So the biodiesel that we use is refined in Ralston, Iowa, and it's a pure soy oil-based biodiesel. And so its hazardous level is significantly less than a petroleum product. We have on site at Fleet Services a 12,000 gallon tank that we're able to fill the trucks that we have that are on that program. Plant sequesters carbon from the atmosphere, so we're not taking carbon-based petroleum products from underground and putting that into the atmosphere, which is never replaced. But the soybean plants will sequester carbon from the atmosphere, and then that's what we use to make the fuel. So it's a circular carbon flow, and that's why it's a renewable energy.
Okay. What is there anything in the future as far as, I know there are companies that are starting to provide all-electric pickup trucks, for example. What does the future hold for some of those bigger pieces of equipment as far as going either a hybrid or an electric situation? Do you have any information on that, Rich?
Yeah, certainly. The one of the things that's unique to the snowplow trucks is that they, when we have a snow event, those trucks are required to haul a lot of weight, mm-hmm. and they're also required to run 24/7 until the event is complete. And so there really isn't an electric product out there right now that can satisfy that. First of all, because the batteries in an electric vehicle offset a lot of the weight capability that we need to haul sand and salt material. And then the other thing is that they really can't stop and charge because they have to keep working. So rather than purchase additional vehicles to satisfy that, it's significantly more economic to just equip them with the biodiesel systems. The other thing about pickup trucks, light cars, they're perfect candidates for an electric program. We can have a lot of those. In fact, we have a couple electric, all electric vehicles now that work great. And we have also several pickups on order that will hopefully be available soon. There's been a delay in the process or the production of those vehicles.
Okay. So that I would assume as you get those vehicles, then you're going to be having, at least in-house, more charge stations set up for that in addition to charge stations for the public. I know those are being added, over a period of time.
Okay. Yeah, absolutely, that's correct. And so that, there's a lot of infrastructure that will be put in place as we move forward into the future over the next several years. If we would like to add vehicles to that as soon as we possibly can. They're an ideal vehicle for the city of Ames city traffic. The vehicles are used primarily within the city limits, and so they're able to charge every day. They can slow charge, which is a significantly lower cost in most cases for those vehicles. Some of the other vehicles, maybe the emergency vehicles as we move more towards electric or other alternative fuels, there's of course hydrogen cell is on the horizon as well.
And speaking of those smaller vehicles, our police cars, have we tried any electric with that system in that part of the fleet?
Right now we have four of our police fleet are hybrid vehicles. Okay. And they do extremely well. The officers like those vehicles. I'm going to guess that we'll have more hybrid vehicles added in the near future to our police fleet as they become available and as they're due to be replaced.
Okay. So it sounds like we're moving in the direction for the future. I'm sure as technology improves, especially the batteries, that I know that's one thing we talk quite a bit about. And with that weight considerations, I can't see that our police force, at least the city force, should have move in that direction as soon as they can. It sounds like a great great step forward. So, and yeah, some of the pickups, I'm waiting for that pickup for the availability at some point for my personal use. But
a lot of those are, a lot of people are waiting.
Yeah. So Rich, is there anything else you want to add about the fleet that I haven't asked you before we break?
Well, I think that the thing that we want to do is we want to let the citizens know that we take all of the costs involved in moving to alternative fuels into consideration, and we make the best decisions based on the goals of carbon reduction, emissions control within our climate action plan. I know Susan and others are working diligently to get that plan done, and it's going to be a great plan for the citizens. And fleet is a component in there. Transportation in our community comprises about 30% of the greenhouse gas emissions. So it's an important factor for us.
Yeah, I know in visiting with Susan about the climate action plan, we've mentioned that in the past, and I know there's a lot of forward movement on that. So really appreciate you visiting with us today and kind of giving us an update on what our fleet situation is.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Rich. Rich Iverson is the fleet manager for the City of Ames. And Susan Guiasta, do you have any final words, or are we good to go?
Well, I just appreciate Rich mentioning, and you mentioning, our climate action plan that is will be coming back this fall to the City Council, and we still continue to work on it. So we'll talk about it again, I'm sure, in the coming weeks.
Okay. Thank you for joining us, Susan. And again, thanks, Rich.
Thanks, Mike.
All right. And now we are going to be visiting with KHOI's own Sam Wormley. And Sam, why are you here today?
Well, Mike, there are a number of things that I would like to share with KHOI listeners. I'd like to talk about the OLLI program. That's the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute at Iowa State, which is available to everybody.
Now, Sam,
I would like to also...
Yeah, OLLI, I always associate OLLI with classes starting at Iowa State, the fall, and we have a winter and then a spring. Have you got some new info?
Well, that's true, Mike. But the OLLI program, if you think about it, during the pandemic, almost all the OLLIs around the country went virtually, which meant that we didn't have to have all the participants be local. And so... OLLI programs have expanded. In fact, the OLLI program at Iowa State now serves 43 counties in Iowa and 21 other states. People from 21 other states take our OLLI programs. The OLLI programs in Montana and Wyoming, North Dakota, South Dakota, Minnesota, and Iowa have teamed up. And this summer in July, the month of July, they're offering 6 free courses. These are one-day courses. You might think of them as lectures that are going to be available to all of the OLLI members in all of those 6 states.
Now, are these, are you talking about when you say all day, you're talking about, or a one day, it's maybe an hour and a half, hour, 2 hours. What is the time frame?
Yeah, the standard length of time for an OLLI class is 1.5 hours. And that's the case for all 6 of these this summer in the month of July. And I just like to give you the titles just to whet our listeners' appetites for these classes. Creating the Plains, a cardiographic exploration with Michael Mullen. Another one is The Art of Marikasa. I guess this is probably an Indian name, Mariska Karaz. Inda Hayford is going to be the lecturer in that course. There's one called No Crying in Baseball, American Pastime and Pop Culture, and The Changing Environment of Nuclear Energy with Gerald Giese, Women Who Serve, the Alphabet Women that from World War II. We have the WAX, the WAVES, and the WMCR and the SPARS. Mary Lou Noskow is going to teach that class. There's U.S. History of Native American boarding schools. And so that just gives you a flavor of what's available, basically free to anybody that's an OLLI member in any of these 6 states.
Any of these 6 states. And gosh, you went right past that baseball offering so quick that I couldn't have any puns about pop flies or anything like that. So,
well, that's good, Mike. I tried to...
Good job, Sam.
I tried to do that on purpose. If anybody wants to know more about any of these OLLI classes, all they have to do is go to olli.iastate.edu. That's olli.iastate.edu, and get information.
Now, Sam, OLLI has been offered for membership 50 years and older. Are you going to be carding folks that join us via Zoom?
You know, Mike, if somebody is 49... we're not going to card them. They might even be 25. They can take these classes. We're not going to check.
As long as they're a member.
As long as they're a member.
Okay. Well, now, we've talked a little bit about OLLI. There are some other things going on that you're involved in, and Central Iowa Symphony is one of those. What is the latest on the Central Iowa Symphony here in Ames?
The Central Iowa Symphony offers 4 regular concerts during the concert season. They are typically the first weekends of October, December, March, and May. But there's also a concert, I call it a Pops-type concert, at Banshell Park in Ames, following the June and July offerings from the municipal band. Then the Central Iowa Symphony always takes that first Thursday of August. In this year, it's August 4th. And that concert is free to everybody. Everyone is involved. I mean, everyone is invited. And also, some other concerts, well, KHOI, for example, broadcasts the Central Iowa Symphony Concerts. We've been doing that for many years now. And we found in the archives some recordings that never got broadcast, and they are being prepared to be broadcast this summer. One from December of 2018 and one from March of 2019. That's exciting to be able to hear those concerts.
Yeah, that's very good. I think I know what you're talking about there. So hopefully we can get one of those out this month even.
Right. And if people want to know more, they can go to the website CI Symphony. That's CISYMPHONY.org. CISymphony.org.
Okay. Thank you, Sam, on that. Now, looking out, looking ahead, reminds me of telescopes. Do you have any updates on that special telescope we've been talking about off and on over the past year or so?
If you'll remember, the Webb Space Telescope was launched on Christmas Day, this last Christmas, and it is now operational and doing science. A week from today, the first scientific images will be released, and it's going to be exciting. Just let me give you a feel for what the administrators and the scientists are reacting to the very first images that have been coming in. NASA's deputy director, Pam Malroy, teased the world when she described the images from the web. She says, "What I have seen moved me as a scientist, as an engineer, and as a human being." And another quote, "There is already some amazing science in the can, and some others are yet to be taken as we go forward. We are in the middle of getting the history-making data down." And this was a quote by Thomas Zurbuchen, who leads the NASA's scientific program. Reconstructing his, you know, if you think about it, he was recounting his first encounter with the data from Webb. Zurbuchen said that he too was in awe of what the telescope had proven capable of. He says he almost cried when looking at the first photos taken of the new instrument. Quote, "It's really hard not to look at the universe in new light and not just to have a moment that is deeply personal," unquote. And he quotes again, "It's an emotional moment when you see nature suddenly releasing some of its secrets. And I would like you to imagine and look forward to that." So, Mike, a week from today, I think we're going to be blown away by what we see. I'm really looking forward to it. We're going to have a whole summer, and the next few years are just going to be loaded with new discoveries about the universe that we live in, how stars form, how planets form, and maybe even some habitable planets around other stars.
Now, my understanding is that this is going to be available online, but also on public television, NOVA is going to have a special event. Is that right?
Right. The NOVA program next week, which will be the day after the images are released, will be about those images and the Webb Space Telescope. So that'll be find your PBS station and enjoy the behind the scenes of how these images were created.
Sam, why all the, what is different about the James Webb that the Hubble telescope, you know, that has provided some amazing images for us. What's different between the Hubble and the James Webb?
Well, the primary differences, Mike, are the Hubble Space Telescope takes images mostly in the visible light range. And it's in low Earth orbit does a fantastic job. At the time that the Hubble was launched, which was, close to 50 years ago, the amount of lift power in the rockets wasn't as great as it is now. And so the mirror of the Hubble Space Telescope is smaller. The James Webb Telescope is much larger, being able to gather more light. And it's also designed to work in the infrared, which allows it to penetrate dust and gas clouds and see further back in time into the history of the universe. It's an infrared telescope. Because it's infrared and sensitive to heat, it's actually put in a position away from the Earth, the Sun, and our Moon, with a shield between the telescope and those bodies to eliminate their heat from, you know, contaminating what they're trying to look at.
Okay. So, but the one thing about Hubble and Webb that's also pointed out is that the Hubble can be repaired or tweaked by astronauts, whereas the James Webb cannot because of where it is. The Hubble launch was in 1990.
Are you sure it was in 1990?
I believe it was in 1990. Paul did a little searching while we were...
Only makes it 32 years old.
But still, that is a heck of a long time when you think about the technology and the changes. The fact that from one mirror to what is the configuration for the Webb?
Well, the Webb is 18 segments so that it creates a bigger mirror. And one important fact is that it is tunable. You were able to repair the Hubble Space Telescope because it was low orbit. You need to be able to make on-the-fly sort of repairs and tweaking out there at the Lagrange 2 point where we can't reach it with human beings.
Yeah,
it's designed to last a good 20 years, and we look forward to a wonderful new science. The Hubble opened up a lot of new science. The Webb will open up a lot more new science.
And I can't help but think that in 20 years, we may have some kind of a robotic mission that could do some repairs or adds to that if needed. So, Sam, I really appreciate the information that you're sharing with us. And we're going to have to let you go back to the telescopes for now. And we're going to have to close this program out. But thanks for joining us and filling us in. KHOI provides a platform for citizen and public officials to air opinions and information. The views of our guests do not necessarily reflect those of KHOI, your community, nonprofit, nonpartisan media. I want to thank Lynn Carey for her assistance in producing this morning's programming, and a tip of a chapeau to Paul Hertz for engineering this morning's local talk. And a big thanks to Sam Wormley for filling us in on some really interesting materials. We heard from Dr. John Passion, the Story County Department of Public Health's chair. And you also heard from Susan Guiasta, Public Information Officer, and Rich Iverson, Fleet Support Manager, both with the City of Ames. And you heard from Steve Lequa on his recent changeover from the written word to hopefully joining us periodically and KHOI sharing his thoughts naturally speaking. Remember that you can also hear this online at khoifm.org, and you can find links to our guests and information you heard during this program. Please consider becoming a member and making KHOI your community radio station with your financial support. And go to our website, khoifm.org, and press the yellow donate button to begin the process. Stay tuned for Democracy Now!, and it's followed by All Things Piano at 9 a.m. Our theme song, as always, is Backtracking by Tom Richards and Al Harris from the Ballad of Kate Shelley. Remember, you, the listener, are what makes KHOI meaningful and possible. Thank you for listening, and thank you for supporting KHOI. We'll see you again on the radio.
On the radio.
This is KHOI 89.1 FM, Story City, Ames.